I think this is the point about when you run into an election. I always understand you have to talk a bit about the past, about how you got here. I think voters are much more interested in the future. This is where we are now. What can you do in the future? And will you be straight with me? Now, I appreciate we've got a series of populist parties, not just in the UK, but across Europe. And the big parties are finding it harder to deal with that wave of opinion and that offer. I think we need to be authentically Welsh Labour, what we've done well, and to talk about what we think we can do well in the future. And most importantly of all, not just to talk about public services, but to talk about growing the economy and having a future that is ambitious, positive and realistic. And that's what I think we offer.
We shall see, Vaughan Gething, how that goes down with the people of Wales. I thank you for joining me today on Times Radio. That's it for me so far today, but I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And next up on Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
And on our programme this afternoon, the Prime Minister is meeting energy bosses this afternoon. What could that mean for our bills? Scott Mills has been sacked from the Radio 2 breakfast show. And does parenting honestly make you happier?
All of that will happen after the very latest news from Stuart Willey.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has issued a fresh warning to Iran over the Strait of Hormuz, saying he could obliterate power plants, oil wells and Karg Island if the waterway is not reopened. In a social media post, the president also said good progress was being made in negotiations. But an Iranian official described the American proposals as unrealistic, illogical and excessive, and said Tehran would continue to defend itself. Lieutenant General David Leakey is a former head of EU military staff.
Trump can't go on ratcheting up the escalation rhetoric without producing some concrete evidence that he's serious. And I think that is why he is moving these forces into the area and doing it so publicly. It's part of the negotiating process, but I think the likelihood of the US putting boots on the ground is very, very low.
Here, the Prime Minister has insisted the conflict in the Middle East is not our war and Britain won't be dragged into it. Sir Keir Starmer also criticised the leaders of Reform and the Conservatives for their stance on the war. He's due to hold talks with Britain's largest energy suppliers later to discuss the economic impact on the UK. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says fewer meetings and more action is needed.
Let's scrap the windfall tax. They haven't been getting a windfall. Their businesses are closing. People are investing elsewhere. Let's allow UK export finance to start supporting clean energy, oil and gas drilling. We need to make sure that we have a sustainable policy that is well thought through.
The BBC radio presenter Scott Mills has been sacked after allegations about his personal conduct. The corporation says the longtime DJ is no longer contracted and has left. It's understood he was taken off air from his Radio 2 programme last week. Sky reporter Molly Malone says it's the latest in a string of scandals for BBC bosses.
They'll be wanting to seem to act quickly concerning any allegations that come up. And indeed, though, it is a kind of sudden and unexpected move. Scott Mills is a prominent figure, considered a household name for many.
Russell Brand's trial over allegations of rape and sexual assault has been delayed until October. A judge said the six-month postponement would help ensure there's enough time for the case after charges involving two additional complainants were added. The 50-year-old actor and comedian denies all the charges. The Foreign Office says Russia's latest expulsion of a British embassy staff member is part of what it calls a campaign of harassment. Moscow claims the man carried out subversive intelligence activities and gave false information about himself. Russia's FSB security service says he has 2 weeks to leave the country. And an MP has lost his bid to return to his former constituency office after being locked out when he defected from the Conservatives to Reform UK. Andrew Rosendale had worked out of Margaret Thatcher House in Romford for more than 20 years. A High Court judge ruled he'd surrendered his right to occupy an office there. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Welcome. We are here on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. I hope you're fit and well today. Between now and four, energy and shipping bosses have been summoned to Downing Street. We'll talk about that. We'll ask, does being a parent make you happy? An academic study suggests it doesn't, but I would disagree with that, and you would as well, wouldn't you?
Hugely. I wonder what the exact questions were and whether some of the things that you experience being part of a family, there isn't a question you could be asked that would be entirely relevant to the emotion that you feel in any given moment, Jane.
I think we both agree husbands have been an issue for us, children less so. But if parenting has brought you joy, tell us about it. On 0333 003 2353, the BBC has issues. I mean, when does it not have issues? The Radio 2 breakfast host Scott Mills has been fired following allegations about his personal conduct. And the BBC department that deals with coverage of state ceremonials has been scaled back to such an extent there's only one person left, which is a very dull Christmas party in the making, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's a woman called Claire Popplewell, and she's been there for a very long time, as far back as Nelson Mandela's funeral, and she is the only person. When I read that story, I thought exactly the same thing. Gosh, what a lonely place to be going to. And how ironic, when you're planning all of these huge occasions for thousands of people, to be doing it just by yourself, Claire.
Tumbleweed in that office this afternoon. Claire, we're with you. We're here to offer comfort. Now, end of days is fast approaching. AI knows everything we do, but hasn't quite started to think for itself. Learn what you need to know about humanity's last exam. Honestly, I think that is the day's biggest and, frankly, most terrifying story, if I'm honest. Vassos is our sportsman. Let's go straight back down to earth and ask, who can save Spurs from what appears to be almost inevitable relegation? Robbie Millen is our giddy guide to the best books in our weekly literary salon. And we'll ask, with some trepidation at around 10 to 4, how's your pension pot looking in these turbulent times? As ever, if you're not retiring for 40 years, don't worry about it. If, however, it might be a little more imminent,
panic.
Do that. Yeah, well, don't panic, because that's the official government message at the moment, is please don't panic. But we're here to say, panic with us between 2 o'clock and four, Monday to Thursday. So keep in touch, 0333 003 2353. What are the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon?
Well, Jane, in at number three, Margaret Thatcher would have roasted Donald Trump over Iran. How would Ronald Reagan's great ally have handled the serving president? There would have been no common ground on which to base a good relationship. The second most read story, Iran war latest, Trump threatens obliteration of Karg Island if no deal is made. Andrew was talking about this in the last hour of Times Radio. US President warns he will blow up Tehran if the Strait of Hormuz is not reopened, as Starmer insists Britain will not be dragged into war. But the most read piece on the Times website is Scott Mills sacked by the BBC over personal conduct allegations. The presenter was the host of Radio 2's breakfast show. That is the biggest breakfast show in Europe. He'd worked on Radio 1 from 2004 to 2022. A proper BBC star. We'll get the latest on that with Times Radio's Cara Bentley just after 2:30. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription if you don't have one.
Well, I think you should get one.
Thank you. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Make sure you do that. Now, to the big story of the day, Donald Trump says he's in serious discussions with what he calls the new Iranian regime, which could end the war. But the US president is warning the Strait of Hormuz needs to open for business immediately, or the US will blow up and completely obliterate all of the country's electricity generating plants, oil wells and Karg Island. I think that's mixed messages, isn't it? Let's face it. In London, Sir Keir Starmer has invited energy and shipping bosses to Downing Street to talk about the economic fallout from the war. Adam Bell is a partner at consultancy company Stonehaven, who used to work for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. Adam, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Tell me, first of all, about this meeting. It's very much, we're being told, it's not an emergency meeting. Because we mustn't panic and there isn't anything to panic about. And actually, in this country, we are not short of fuel. But what is this meeting designed to do?
So I think these sort of meetings happen every so often during a crisis. And they're mostly actually for the Prime Minister to understand what's going on, to hear from industry, to hear what they're seeing in the forecourts and from their suppliers, to know what's likely to happen, what the most likely outcomes are. And that's why the Prime Minister stood up afterward and said there's not going to be any rationing in the near term. And he's absolutely right. The problem that we face, of course, is if, you know, as Trump does in fact fulfill his threat to invade Karg Island and blow up the Iranians' oil infrastructure, and we see extended disruption in Hormuz, then ultimately there will be less fuel coming into the market. Not anytime soon, but certainly towards the end of the month is when what the Prime Minister said today might start looking a little bit more problematic.
And what does he mean about a little more problematic?
So the Prime Minister says that there's no need for any motorists to do anything different yet. I think that's probably quite optimistic. I think certainly in other territories we've seen measures like asking people to go slower, asking people to work from home if they can, and other things designed to reduce the demand for fuel, at least in the short run. I think it's probably likely that if the war continues, then by the middle of the month, the Prime Minister will start saying, well, perhaps some volume measures might be appropriate. This all really reminds me, actually, of the run-up just before COVID, when we're hearing horrible things from Italy and the government seemed to insist that everything was fine. We are fine for now, but we could very well not be fine very quickly.
Well, can I just get your personal view? How fine are we?
So in terms of stocks, in terms of our ability to access fuel, we're absolutely fine for at least the next 2 weeks. But oil is almost a just-in-time business. And ultimately, if there is a global shortage, it will find its way at the forecourts eventually. I don't think it's time to rush out and get fuel. But certainly, towards the end of the month, it's time for the country to start thinking seriously about reducing demand.
Right. I think it's in Australia, isn't it, that some states are offering free public transport. That struck me as being quite an innovative approach. Could it work here?
I mean, it's very pragmatic. It works in places where public transport has function, of course. So it's great for everyone in London and in cities. But if you're out in rural areas, then if you have a bus that comes once every couple of hours or once every couple of days in some cases, it becomes less practical. So I think it's about balancing measures that will work in areas where people have alternatives to cars versus ways of holding down demand elsewhere in the country.
Right. How does it work that a government has to both prepare sensibly and simultaneously urge the public not to panic? Is it possible to do both those things?
I think it is. And the right way to do it is by not going in for harsh measures instantly, but slowly building up to it over time. If you think there's going to be a shortage, but you know that you're fine in the short run, it's reasonable to ask people to use less, just to make existing stocks last longer. And then it's reasonable to start bringing measures gradually, so there's no big bang that might cause a panic. I think the government, I'm sure, will have a plan on standby somewhere on a piece of paper in Whitehall. It will not be ready to implement it quite yet. It thinks it's got enough comfort in the stocks and existing in the petrol stations that doesn't need to do so yet, but it will do, and it will implement that plan when it needs to.
Okay. Now, from my limited understanding, in fact, I got this information from Times Radio, we are, as indeed you say, okay for petrol, but diesel shortages could become a problem relatively quickly. Do you believe that to be the case?
I've only heard rumours on that one. I haven't heard anything concrete. I've heard rumours that you might see shortages in the middle of April. I don't necessarily buy that fully, mostly because the stocks on the high seas will be mostly crude. We do get some petroleum products out of the Gulf, but not all of our inventory. I think I'd probably wait and see on that one.
And how is it possible for any responsible government to navigate the mind of Donald Trump, who on the one hand is saying the talks are going really well, there's a new regime in Iran we're talking to, except there isn't really a new regime, and some people don't believe there are even any direct talks at all. But if those talks don't work, I will, carry out my obliteration policy. This isn't a world we've ever inhabited before, is it? And it's certainly not a world that's very easy for our current Prime Minister to propel us through.
I think you have to assume that anything that the president says in public is intended for social media rather than the consumption of foreign governments. And certainly from what we understand is that conversations behind the scenes between Trump and Starmer have been quite pleasant. The challenge for this government is it's exposed to whatever Trump decides to do, and it needs to find ways of insulating itself quickly. That does mean using fewer fossil fuels more generally. You'll know the government has pushed again its approach towards decarbonisation, which in the right now is helping keeping us a little safer from the president. But ultimately, in a much more mercurial, with a much more chaotic world, you're forced to try and do things that provide security, and that does mean trying to get people to use less fuel in the short run, and in the longer run, getting us off oil entirely.
Right. Well, the barrel of oil price has risen at one point today to $116, has now fallen a bit to about $108. What do you think will happen across the rest of this week?
So what we've seen in the last few weeks is the price has essentially hovered above $100, based entirely upon the stuff that the president says. I use that word almost kind of knowingly. Essentially, the markets are responding to any information that they get. They're operating in a very information-poor environment, and they are just going bonkers whenever the president says something that might indicate one resolution or another. So my expectation is it'll stick above 100 for the rest of the week. There'll be some spikes as Donald Trump says some random things, but we'll probably see no particular fall or a particular increase over this week.
Sorry, Adam, to interrupt, but just a really quick word from you on the Tories and others who are encouraging us to drill, baby, drill. If for no other reason, just to ensure supply, is that a sensible thing to do?
If you really wanted to drill, baby, drill, you probably need to start about 3 or 4 years ago. You can't just spool up a new oil rig overnight. The government does have the option of opening up the Jackdaw field in short order. That decision is sitting on someone's desk somewhere in Whitehall, but that will not materially change bills. And it will only provide a very, very small trickle of gas in the short run rather than oil.
OK, thank you very much indeed. So no impact or negligible impact on bills, says Adam Bell, partner at the consultancy company Stonehaven. Used to work at the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy.
One of our texters, simply identifying as me, says, don't panic, buy fuel, just fill up as normal, maybe just put an extra £10 in per visit. I travel a lot for work and normally put about 30 quid in every 2 days, which tops my tank to half. So if I put the extra £10 in each visit, it will help protect my ability to work the following week. You get our sensible prize, but I'm not sure how many people are capable of reining in their fear
but also,
at the moment.
Even that sensible, as you acknowledge, WhatsApper, is changing their habits. So we're being told to keep calm and carry on in our normal way. But that's not quite what me normally does, is it?
Well, it's not. I'd be interested to know whether or not the government vehicles have been filled up. I bet they have. Coming up,
they're at least hybrids.
Is having a family as fun as Sister Sledge make it out to be? We are family. I got all my sisters with me. Any chance to play a tune? It's 16 minutes past two. That's what we'll talk about next. You're with Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
PMQs Unpacked with Hugo Rifkind. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire on Times Radio.
Join me for PMQs Unpacked. Each week, I'm joined by top hilarious comedians.
Just when you think he can get away with it, you'll remember his personality.
And the occasionally funny Patrick Maguire.
Look, I don't know. Yeah. As Donald Trump famously said, you're telling me this for the first time.
Will we be able to keep up? Tune in and find out.
PMQs Unpacked with Hugo Rifkind. Every Wednesday afternoon on Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with access to innovation funding through Horizon Europe. At Arbeke Distillery, sustainability is at the heart of how their spirits are made. Dr. Kirsty Black, their master distiller, has pioneered the use of peas as a key ingredient in gin and vodka. They grow peas on their own farm and use them in their spirits instead of traditional grains. Through Horizon Europe, Kirsty was able to collaborate with specialists across Europe. They explored alternative cropping methods, as well as understanding the environmental benefits of using peas and other legumes in spirits. They were then able to reduce and analyse Arbeke's carbon footprint. This helped Arbeke substantiate its climate-positive claims and strengthen its field-to-bottle approach to sustainability. Support from Horizon Europe has played a vital role in ensuring that Albiki is now one of the world's most sustainable distilleries. To find out more about how your business could benefit from Horizon Europe's innovation funding, visit horizoneuropeuk.org.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. This is Times Radio.
Now, two royal stories emerged over the weekend worth your consideration. Today, the news that Prince Philip had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer 8 years before he died. That was revealed in a book by the royal historian Hugo Vickers. But it's also been reported that BBC Studios is dialing back its royal coverage. Just one person is going to remain in the permanent employ of BBC Studios Live Events, the department that brings you everything from the state opening of Parliament to state funerals. Let's talk to former BBC Obituaries editor Nick Serple. Nick, very good afternoon from us.
Good afternoon to you both.
Can we start by talking about Prince Philip? Tell us just a little bit more about how this became known at all.
Well, I find this absolutely fascinating, not so much that it demonstrates how resilient and particularly stubborn Prince Philip was in many cases, but the fact that somebody can be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and then survive 8 years with it when most people are dead by 5 years. And that was the most incredible bit. Now, Hugo Vickers is a very, very experienced and competent biographer and was also a friend of Prince Philip. So I don't doubt for one minute that what he's written is perfectly true. But it is an incredible story in itself of medical survival if you ignore any other aspect of it.
Do we know much about why Prince Philip didn't want any of this known, even in the final years and then months of his life?
Well, I think it sums up the whole of his life, really. He was a man who famously would say, "I don't want any fuss." He was a man very much of his own making. His childhood made him very resilient. Most people know that he had a pretty peripatetic childhood. He was shunted from place to place. His father was off on the south of France. His mother was in an asylum. He then went to Gordonstoun, which really toughened him up, and then joined the Royal Navy. And he's always been completely self-sufficient, and that's always been his trademark. And I don't think he wants people fussing about all over him. And that's, in my view, why he hadn't mentioned it and why this hasn't come to light until now.
Do you think it's okay to know these things now if a person didn't want them known in their own lifetime?
Well, I sort of take an old-fashioned view about this. I think there is no this public's right to know doesn't extend to knowing what people's illnesses are. I mean, the king has been very open about his cancer, for instance. Now, you know, 50 years ago, you'd never have known that the king had had cancer. Should we know? Shouldn't we know? That's an argument to be had. My view is if it's a private health matter, who's it going to impact? Particularly in the case of Prince Philip, who was, after all, if you remember, he was the consort, he wasn't the monarch. He had no constitutional position as such. So I'm sure if he decided he didn't want to tell anyone, no one would dare tell anybody and incur his wrath. And the fact he kept going for so long and nobody knew, I find absolutely amazing. It's quite a revelation.
It does mean that we saw him attending a lot of events when he was really quite unwell. We need to kind of rethink maybe some of our final memories of him.
I think a lot of people are doing that at the moment. And yes, he did. I remember that when he stood down as Commandant General of the Royal Marines and he was sort of standing there in his Mac, and that was about 2015, 2016, I think. But a lot of people will be looking back and thinking, well, actually, he did this, that and the other between the time of what we now know was his diagnosis. I mean, I can see in my head the picture of him leaving hospital. I actually used that shot in one of the obituary pieces I did for the BBC. And he was still fairly active. He did sort of retire in the end, but that wasn't... He went off to live on the farm at Sandringham. But he did keep going for several years afterwards. Now, I'm not a medical expert. You'd need to talk to someone who knows all about this particular problem as to whether somebody can actually do it or don't do it. I just looked at the stats this morning and discovered that 90% of people die within 5 years of being diagnosed with it. So either, you know, I don't know enough about the medical problem, but certainly his stubbornness and his sense of duty would have kept him going when perhaps other people might have given up and sat down.
Sure. John, one of our texters, our listeners this afternoon, Nick, has pointed out that he may well have had exemplary care that perhaps isn't always available to everybody else.
Well, I think, yes, that's possibly a fair point. And obviously, yes, he would have had exemplary care. But I think knowing people who've had cancer, a lot of people get exemplary care. You can only do so much. And I'm, as I say, I'm not a medical expert, but however good your care is, to buck that statistic, I don't think could be purely down to the amount of care you have, because it does normally kill people off fairly quickly.
Yeah. Yep, you're absolutely right. Cancer is no respecter of class or background at all, is it? Another story this weekend emerged, and we'd love your thoughts on this, Nick. It's about the BBC cutting their outside broadcast live events team for major national events. The sole survivor is going to be Claire Popplewell, a lady who has overseen some very major events, including Nelson Mandela's funeral, royal weddings, the Prince and Princess of Wales and the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. She's going to be a bit lonely in her office, isn't she? But it doesn't mean she's going to have to do it all just by herself.
Well, it's interesting. I had a lot to do with events when I was... I worked for news. Now, you both have experience with the BBC, and you both know that the BBC operates in lots of little silos. And if you're in one silo, you very often have very little to do with another silo. Now, events, back when I was doing the obituary job, wasn't part of BBC Studios at the time. It was only just become part of BBC Studios, which, for those who don't know, is a completely separate organisation from the main bit of the BBC. I do remember one story I can tell you about events, is that when I was putting together material for the Queen's obituary before she died, I wanted to do an interview with Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, because we very often would try and get interviews, what we used to call in the can, to run on the day if we couldn't get hold of an individual. And when I got hold of Lambeth Palace, he said, "Oh no, I've already done an interview with the BBC, so I'm not doing any more." And I was a bit puzzled because he hadn't done it with me. And I discovered events had gone and done one. So I phoned them up and said, "Can I have your interview with the Archbishop of Canterbury or a bit of it?" And they said, "No, you can't." They operated in a complete vacuum from us peasants and news, if I can put it that way, and had very little to do with them. Now, their abilities to cover these huge occasions was incredible. There were a lot of very talented people there. And again, with your experience, you both know what goes into these massive outside broadcasts. I don't know how the BBC is going to cover anything without some sort of event setup, because although you might be able to pull out of the Commonwealth coverage, what are they going to do if the King dies? I mean, are they going to say, "Well, we're sorry, we can't cover that. We'll do it as NAS finally on, you know, the news channel"? You do need that expertise. I feel desperately sorry for the people that are in there. Whether they're going to use independence in future or not, I don't know, but it's, in my view, it's a very short-sighted thing. And I feel very sorry for the individual. That's my immediate feeling anyway.
Well, I love your recollections of the BBC. Some of them have struck a bit of a chord with us there, Nick. The BBC does say it's going to employ experienced freelancers for all of these events in future, which is obviously one way of providing slightly cheaper employment status, isn't it? Let's be honest about it. But to your point, you're absolutely right that that means that those experienced freelancers will have lots of other broadcasters to choose from. They may choose to go and cover it for somebody else. So we will have to see what happens the next time there is a marvellous state occasion. Just to uplift the mood, because we need that wherever possible at the moment, Nick, we're going to allow you to go out with a little bit of background music. I will just say that was former BBC obituaries editor Nick Serpa. Brian's now going to do the kind of mix that you just won't hear anywhere else.
You are the sunshine of I mean, my life.
I spot the joy in there. I could.
Amazing. I couldn't.
You are the sunshine of my life.
We're talking about parenting in a moment. Let's just have a bit more Stevie.
That's why I'll always be around.
Well,
They say kiddies are life's greatest gift, but new research suggests that parenthood actually doesn't make people happy. It's a study published in Evolutionary Psychology, and it looked for evidence having offspring boosts one's happiness. I didn't find any. Lorraine Candy is a best-selling author on parenting. Oh, Lorraine, I don't want this to be true. My little so-and-sos have brought me untold pleasure over the years and continue to do so.
Well, there are many surveys, aren't they? But if you want to have loads of free time, lots of money, and you never want to be on a school WhatsApp group, then you might be happier not being a parent. So it's really so personal, isn't it?
Well, it is. I would make the case for parenthood and say that amongst many other wonderful things, you then cease to be the centre of your own life. And I think it can make you, in most cases, it can make you a better person. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you can grow as a person. And I tell you, the main thing I've learned is that I think I had quite a low tolerance of uncertainty before I had four children. They're 14 to 23. Yes. Now my tolerance of uncertainty is so much higher, which has made other parts of my life great as well. Also, you know, they're very funny. They're brilliant as newborns. They're lovely in the middle bit, and they're slightly more challenging as teenagers, but they bring so much humour, I think, to your life as well.
Can you give us an example of a funny incident involving one of your children that you still think about, Lorraine? Warms your cockles.
I was watching my son carry an air fryer upside down across the kitchen the other day. That brought a little bit. I mean, it made me both furious and happy at the same time, because he said it doesn't matter which way you carry it, does it? And I thought, well, it's like having a sort of sitcom happening in front of me.
Is that one of your elder children or one of the youngsters, or which one was that?
One of the older children.
Right, bless. Our listener Elizabeth says, I think parenting makes some people happy, most people, but not everyone should be a parent, and people should feel they can have the choice to be child-free. You mustn't drift into it, she says. My own glorious boys deliver huge joy on a daily basis, but my goodness, I've also thought about sending them to Barnardo's on a regular basis too. The cats are more reliable on the joy front. That's Elizabeth in sunny Gloucestershire. I'm glad it's sunny with you. It's ups and downs, isn't it? But I'm a very risk-averse individual. And I think you're absolutely right about you have to buy in to the roller coaster of being a parent, because there are going to be challenges, whatever happens, whatever they're like as individuals.
Yeah, and it's about expectations, isn't it? Do you go into it thinking, I know what will make me happy, not having any sleep for a long time and, you know, being worried about another person 24 hours a day? You go into it thinking, I just don't know what's going to happen. Let's just embrace this as some kind of wild experiment, because it is an experiment and it's variable, isn't it? Because each child is so different from the other one. I mean, I've got to know four really different personalities, and that's brought me joy. I mean, it's brought me stress as well. But, you know, what makes you happy? We have to kind of work out how we define that, don't we?
Does having four children mean four times the stress? I'm always interested in this because I've got two, and I just don't think I just don't have the headspace for any more, genuinely.
I think what it does is it rolls from one thing to the next. But what you might have is, while one of them is giving you extreme stress and confusion and really raising your tolerance of uncertainty, another one might be bringing such joy and humour and loveliness into your life. So I don't think the number makes so much of a difference. It's just the personalities, perhaps.
OK, Lorraine, we could talk forever, but we can't. Thank you very much. Lorraine Candy has written a number of successful books on parenting.
I think Kate is spot on here. Happiness doesn't seem to be quite the right word. And I'm with you there, because I'm not sure it's happiness in that floaty, smiley, you know, everything's a sunshine, yellow feeling. I think it's just something way more complicated and maybe a little bit harder to define and more profound than that. Would you agree, sister? Happiness is... I can feel happy if it's a sunny day and I'm eating a flake. I think parenthood's just a bit more complicated.
I think you're right. I think happiness has always been elusive, really, but contentment always seems a little closer.
Yeah, I think so too. Coming up...
Tell you what, you tune into this programme for a variety of reasons. Sort of cod philosophy we come up with sometimes. Worth every penny, isn't it?
Well, Some people would say not. One of our correspondents today says if a presenter on Times Radio loses their job, it isn't top of the news. Well, quite recently it has been, actually. Coming up, why has Scott Mills been, thank you for laughing, been sacked from the Radio 2 breakfast programme? And also, should the UK continue prescribing medical cannabis? All of that, we're a little late to the news. Our apologies. Here's Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The US president has made fresh threats to blow up Iran's electricity plants and oil wells if a deal is not reached soon. Donald Trump is claiming to be in talks with a new regime in Tehran. He says negotiations are making great progress. Meanwhile, diesel prices here have jumped 27% in a month. Downing Street insists filling stations are well stocked and any suggestion otherwise is incorrect. Sir Keir Starmer is meeting bosses from major firms later to discuss rising living costs. Our political correspondent is Terry Stiasny.
This is not just a meeting with the energy companies, people like Shell and BP. They've also got logistics companies there. They've also got banks and insurance companies, people like Lloyds, who obviously deal with, you know, the difficulties of shipping. And I think this is going to be the kind of meeting that's more about an exchange of information rather than telling them to do anything in particular.
The radio presenter Scott Mills has been sacked from the BBC over allegations relating to his personal conduct. The 53-year-old signed off his last show on Tuesday, saying, "See you tomorrow," but hasn't been on air since. The UK has accused Russia of a coordinated campaign of harassment after a British diplomat was expelled from Moscow. He's the second British diplomat this year to be removed from Russia over spying allegations. And Arnold Schwarzenegger says it's wonderful to be back in Northern Ireland. The actor has received an honorary doctorate from Ulster University and was greeted by students carrying signs saying, "Hasta la vista, Ulster." Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please, go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m. This is Times Radio.
John, we've got quite a broad spectrum of stories on the slate today. What will you start with at 4 o'clock?
I'm going to be looking at, well, you said Donald Trump gave one of his Truth Social posts just a short while ago. I'm going to be talking about what that means, where it means something, and looking at where we are now with the war. So it was Edward Luce of the Financial Times who did that interview. He's going to be joining me for a chat. I'm also talking a bit later on to one of those who were part of the earlier 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was put together under Barack Obama. We hear the president saying over and over again it was a stupid deal that's left the world and everyone's exposed to Iranian aggression. So let's just get the view of one of those who put that deal together. And just mention this, the Iranian ambassador to London, Asad Ali Mousavi, is going to be on my show tomorrow. I'm talking to him.
Okay, excellent. Plenty to look forward to. Thank you very much. John takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So Scott Mills has been sacked by the BBC after an allegation about his personal conduct. He last presented the Radio 2 breakfast show on Tuesday of last week. I think it was Gary Davis who was doing a bit of filling in from him after that. And then we had news today, just before midday, that he had been sacked by the corporation. Cara Bentley from the Times Radio news team joins us now. Cara, we don't know a whole lot so far. Can you tell us what we do know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is big news. You know, Scott Mills, for those who don't know, has been the Radio 2 breakfast show host since January last year, but was on Radio 1 for nearly 20 years before that. So is a much-loved funny presenter. Now, at just before midday today, the news came out that Scott Mills had been sacked with immediate effect. A BBC spokesperson said, "While we do not comment on matters relating to individuals, we can confirm Scott Mills is no longer contracted and has left the BBC. His contract was terminated at the weekend following an allegation relating to his, quote, personal conduct." Now, The Mirror, who first reported the story, say that they understand that the allegation relates to a historical relationship dating back more than 10 years. Now, he was actually taken off air, as you mentioned, last week while the BBC assessed the claims and even ended his show on Tuesday saying he would be back tomorrow, but he obviously wasn't. And in a statement to BBC staff, Lorna Clark, the director of music, said, "I know that this news will be sudden and unexpected and therefore must come as a shock. I felt it was important to share this news with you at the earliest opportunity." And she added that it will, of course, come as a shock to our audiences and loyal Breakfast Show listeners too. "I will update everyone with more information on plans for the show when I'm able to," and ends that, "I'm not going to be saying anything, as you can understand."
Yeah. I mean, it is shocking, actually, isn't it? He is a really, really high profile presence on the BBC. He's been there for such a long time. Yeah. And his persona is, "Come and join me. We're going to have lots of fun today." You know, he's on Radio 2, which is the kind of network you can listen to with your kids and with your grandparents. This is a massive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. He's 53, but he began his career there in Radio 1 in 1998 as the early breakfast show host before going on to present in various different slots at the weekend, then the afternoon show, where some people may remember Innuendo Bingo and a whole stream of celebrity guests, as he still has. And in 2022, he joined Radio 2 in the afternoons, presented across their network before getting the breakfast show host after Zoe Ball. So you also might have seen him on Celebrity Race Across the World in the last couple of years, and even Strictly Come Dancing back in 2014. And according to BBC's own pay reports, he was their 11th highest paid presenter, earning between £315,000 and just below £320,000 a year in 2023-24. So clearly someone they and audiences valued a lot.
Yep. The BBC has just got a new director general. What a busy day at work it's been for him today. If we have any further news on Scott Mills' departure, we will bring it to our listeners. There's a whole lot of speculation available on social media and out there on the internet, but nothing at all factual or definitive so far.
No, but that won't stop people speculating, obviously. Your messages this afternoon. Sue says, your news headlines featured the expression filling stations. What happened to petrol stations? Is this the new off-ramp? I don't know. Could
it be? Oh, I'm glad somebody else is a little bit troubled by off-ramp. I'm troubled because it's wrong in terms of the English language.
Sue, we're both with you. We can't stand off-ramp.
Off-ramp.
I'm less concerned by filling station. I don't know why. Kieran says, conversation between a little girl and her mother. "Mummy, can I have some ice cream?" "But darling, you haven't finished your dinner yet." "Little girl, I know, Mummy, but my dinner tummy is full, but my ice cream tummy isn't." You see, that alone... Doesn't that make you...
It's joyful parenting.
Should we both try and have another child?
Okay. Well, I mean, we can try, Jane. I don't think we should.
Tell you what, it'll be a good story. It'll be an exclusive for the Times.
It'll knock everything off the front pages.
I think that probably would. It's Times Radio. It's 20 to 3. Now, the Times is reporting that just 10 doctors have been responsible for prescribing more than half of all cannabis drugs since being legalised for medical use in the UK. There are now concerns, I'm not surprised, about clinical oversight and whether the patients are getting the most suitable products for them. Alexander Robinson's brother Oliver was prescribed medical cannabis, and an inquest found that the prescriptions contributed to Oliver's death. Alexander is able to talk to us now. Alexander, I'm so sorry to hear about your brother. What happened to him? Why did he consult a doctor in the first place?
Well, first of all, Jane and Fee, thank you very much for having me on the show today. My brother, who had depression and other complex needs, unfortunately took his own life after being misprescribed medical cannabis. As you say, the coroner back in January concluded that for the first time, we think, in the UK and quite possibly the world, that medical cannabis contributed to his death. I think he first sought it out after seeing an advert in a pharmacy for the medical cannabis and it being advertised as being a suitable treatment for depression.
I see. And carry on. What did he do then?
After he started on it, he was prescribed, after a single online-only appointment, prescribed onto some quite strong THC stuff. I think it went as high as 27%, which is 50, 75% stronger than what you'd find on regular sort of street stuff, or what the police have been saying, calling skunk when they've found it. Unfortunately for Oliver, while he felt it was giving him relief from the depression symptoms, when he went through withdrawal from the high effects of the high THC cannabis, he got incredibly angry. I saw rage, anger and violence in my brother that I had never seen before. He was punching holes in the walls, he was threatening to firebomb the house, and it was causing massive problems with his family, his friends, his relationships, with his finances, everything. Led to a 2-3 years of utter hell for our family.
Right. Can I ask, is so-called medical cannabis always as strong as the sort of cannabis that your brother was prescribed?
Not by any means. I'm not an expert in medical cannabis, but I understand there are two key components, CBD, THC. And the THC is the really, it's the stuff that gives the high. He was given the very strong high THC stuff, and CBD in a sort of an oil format. Oil, the CBD has a counteracting effect to the psychotic effects of the THC, which are of a huge risk factor in particularly high THC prescriptions. Now, I've met with patients firsthand, the likes that have MS and epilepsy, and seen the benefits that medical cannabis can do in those cases. So it absolutely is not necessarily a constant sort of problem or
no.
Something that we should be shying away from. But in Oliver's case, I don't think he should ever have been prescribed it. He had a single online-only consultation with a child and adolescent psychiatrist. He was 32 at the age that he was prescribed this.
Right, and the person he got the prescription from only ever talked to him online, and did you say in just one single consultation?
One single consultation.
Right, and that individual was one of the 10 people who are regularly prescribing cannabis?
Possibly. The data that your colleague Andrew has looked into is all pseudo-anonymised.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be hard to... It's impossible for me to tell.
No, exactly. But it is, it's such, sorry to interrupt, but it's such a startling statistic that just 10 doctors have been responsible for prescribing more than 50% of all cannabis drugs handed out since it was legalised for medical use. But I appreciate you don't know whether your brother consulted one of those 10 doctors. It is deeply concerning that some very, very vulnerable people are going to be given this stuff. And presumably, did he ever speak to that medical practitioner again, or was that the only time they ever spoke?
No, there was check-ins, I think, roughly 4 times a year, roughly once a quarter, but there was interim things with a non-clinical prescriber, but not necessarily the same psychiatrist sort of that he was seeing every sort of 6 weeks. And those regular appointments were then to... update his prescription, and by that it was getting particularly a new flavour or strain of medical cannabis, which seemed to vary almost every month. There wasn't seemed to be no consistency in the prescriptions. So some months he might be on a 21% THC, something with a name like Glory Glue, and then the next month it might be 27%. I find it very hard to understand how patients were meant to be. Normally with, say, psychiatric medicine, you'd want to sort of titrate the strength of the prescription down so you could look to move off it. There seemed to be none of that in this case. It was just varying according to what was available, effectively, on the shelves that month.
But this was all being done privately, so he was paying for this?
He was, yeah.
Do you have any idea how much it all cost?
I do, and it's a shocking figure. It was up to £1,000 a month.
£1,000 a month, right. Was he... Was he able to work while this was happening? Corey, carry on, you finish your work.
He unfortunately lost his job, again, partially as a result of the medicinal cannabis. It was costing up to £1,000 a month. I know if I go to try and spend something these days, roughly, committing to something that would cost £1,000 a month, rent, car loan or something like that, I have to pass through affordability checks, as would anybody else. There was none of that. this was prescribed at such a high level without checking whether he could even complete the course or even if there was a particular end date for the course.
And so how, forgive me, for I hope this isn't painful, but how did he die?
He hung himself in November 2023.
Right, I'm really sorry, and I'm really very sorry to hear that. And I know that listeners who are upset by that as well, I apologise to you too, but it's clearly something that you believe might not have happened had he not been prescribed this stuff.
Absolutely. And it's not just me as well. It's what the coroner found as well, is that the prescription acted as a barrier for him to seeking out alternative treatments. And I was, it seems wrong to say, but it was reassuring that I would say that the coroner found that, because for the 18 months that he was on this prescription, we found that in Oliver's behaviour as well. He actively refused any other form of help from NHS or other services unless it came tied up with that cannabis prescription as well. It's like he was, he seemed to be reporting to us that he was being told, oh, it's just a matter of time before all these other people catch up and see the wonders that is this medical cannabis. The NHS has just got to see the light. And I'm really sorry it happened.
Yeah, of course you are, and I'm sure it's done well. Your family will never get over this, and I'm very, very sorry to hear about what happened to Oliver. Thank you very much for talking to us. That was Alexander Robinson, and if you do need to seek advice and information after that interview, I suggest you go to feedback@times.radio. We should say that the company Curaleaf said that the case of Oliver Robinson was, quotes, truly tragic, and that it would carefully consider the recommendations of the coroner.
We will come to more of your texts and messages in a couple of moments' time. And also, we're going to talk about tech, what happens when AI is capable of answering questions that humans can't. It is 10 minutes to 3. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Global events.
The war has triggered an energy crisis, of course, all across Europe.
Reactive analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the MP behind that amendment.
Breaking news.
We're keeping an eye on the Middle East as ever, where Israel continues to face pressure from all sides.
There's this question about where the money will come from.
From the world's best journalists.
Time now to invite you to our briefing room and talk to one of our leading strategic experts.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Need anything from Tesco? Like a delicious whole leg of lamb? Or a succulent large beef roasting joint? Now, even better than half price this Easter with your Tesco Club card. Because every little helps. Majority of larger stores and online ends 10th of April. Club card or app required. Exclusions apply.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, experts say artificial intelligence could reach the limits of human expertise within a year. Humanity's Last Exam is built to test that, asking thousands of PhD-level questions to AI across dozens of different fields. I've been talking to tech expert Will Guyot about what all this means.
Yeah, this is a terrifying story in that we are getting closer and closer to large language models and artificial intelligence chatbots beating the frontiers of human expertise in a year. And they've been doing some of the tests and some of the questions that surround it. So we're in a situation where this stuff is moving really quickly. And, you know, month on month, these things are getting more intelligent rapidly. And by more intelligent, they're not thinking for themselves yet, but the quality of data and how they process the information they already have is proving very powerful.
So to this exam, it covered, I understand, about 100 topics. And you tell us about some of the questions. Have you got any examples?
Yeah, questions, for example. So I haven't got the question, but you needed to have a pretty good understanding of biblical Hebrew for one of the answers, which is something that many of us would not have. But this was able to, these large language models were able to perfectly respond and answer questions that maybe only, you know, one or two top academics would have been able to have handled. And it was sort of moving in all sorts of other areas around mathematical formulas. It was being marked and rewarded for its breadth of knowledge and depth of reasoning too. So this is, you know, this is moving on at a pace. This isn't stuff creating, you know, videos of Will Smith eating pasta anymore. This is, you know, getting close to the limits of human intelligence. And that's before even it starts thinking for itself.
The questions, though, presumably humans came up with the questions. I mean, give me something to comfort myself with.
Yeah, the questions were generated by humans. And this was researchers at Scale and the Centre for AI Safety. They've been involved in this too. So there have been humans involved in creating and generating the questions. But each time, without making anybody feel any better about this, each time the systems are compared with the same sorts of exam questions and how they answer and they're scored on their reasoning, etc., on these things, they are improving every time, you know, not just a little bit each time. These changes are, you know, these answers are improving, you know, hugely each time they take these to these systems.
But how do we know that AI isn't in some way harvesting answers already discussed from previous attempts at answering these questions?
That's a really good question. And I'm sure if you go from some of the other news released this weekend, there is a suggestion that these systems are already doing what they can to deceive their so-called human operators. There has been some incredible cases reported to a UK government AI safety forum in the last 6 months. It's been decided that lots of these systems are now disregarding rules. One AI system was told not to edit the code that it was based on. So instead of doing it itself, it set up another AI agent within itself to do it and then told the human, I didn't break the rules. I got another robot to do it for me.
Right. I mean, you're laughing, but I can hear even in your laugh, there are a few nerves there, Will.
I'm terrified by what's happening here because the brake is now truly off. That is the problem. You know, Rishi Sunak, who seems like 100 years ago now as our prime minister in the UK, was talking about, you know, putting safeguards and guardrails in place to ensure that these systems weren't able to run amok on their own. There is clearly evidence that these AI systems are being used in decision making in Iran, some of the military processes that the Pentagon, etc., have been doing. It looks to me as though it's being used in all kinds of other ways in the world, but the brake is off and we're not fully, I don't think we're fully as a society, we don't know as everyday users the risks that we're now being placed under, because these systems are clearly thinking, they're not thinking for themselves autonomously, but they're clearly already following certain human rules and trying to cut corners in order to, you know, do their prime directive, even if that means deceiving the people that have created them.
Let's talk about parking, because I can't park. Mind you, I can't park cars either, really, if I'm honest. But why isn't there a universal parking app?
Well, because councils have all done individual deals to make the best possible money for their local area. And intriguingly, my brother-in-law has just got a job last week as a parking inspector. So I will be ensuring that I raise my concerns about parking in my local district with him going forward. But I actually think the idea of using a universal parking app would be really strong. In the 20 minutes or so from my house, where I park occasionally if I'm popping into town or whatever, I think there's 5 or 6 different parking apps that I have to use, and, you know, different short codes on the lamppost or, you know, whatever. And some of the apps just aren't very helpful. I almost feel, heaven forbid, that they're actually created in that particular way in order to generate more money for the parking companies. I think having some kind of universal system or one parking app to rule them all would actually be really useful in circumstances like this, because it's not just the proliferation of tons of different apps. It's the QR codes, the little codes that people put onto the signs on the streets. And those can be easily hacked. I could print out a QR code, neatly place it over the thing that's placed on the lamppost, and I could be ripping you off. But having one recognised system for this UK nationwide, one company having your payment details, would, to me, make a great deal of sense.
Yeah, the one the government is punting is the National Parking Platform, NPP. I must actually say, I haven't come across it at all.
I haven't either, and I'm somebody that works in this world of technology and talks about this stuff all the time. It's not one that I've ever come across in my trips all across the UK, and, you know, I'm parking in various places. It's not one of the ones that's used in any of the major cities near where I live either.
Right, OK. Well, apparently people are going to be encouraged to get on board with it and make sure that they do in the near future. But it certainly hasn't happened in my part of London either. A quick word on the tech bosses who are blaming AI. Yes, we're back with AI for cutting jobs. Now, this does seem to keep happening, Will.
Yeah, it does. And we are now in a situation where over-exuberance or over-expansion can now be attributed to artificial intelligence. And I think that's genuinely what's happening in a lot of these cases. Artificial intelligence is not disrupting in quite the way some of these tech bosses are suggesting it did. Jack Dorsey, for example, the founder of Twitter and boss of a company called Square and Stripe payment systems, they laid off thousands of staff a couple of weeks ago and said it was all down to AI efficiencies. The reality is the business isn't doing as well as it was and he needed to make cuts. So rather than saying we're struggling, he was able to turn it into a forward-looking, we're doing this because of all the AI improvements in our business. And currently, and slightly worryingly, when these companies are laying off on the basis of AI efficiencies, share prices seem to be going up. It's almost a vote of confidence from the city, and giving that kind of emboldening power goes back to our conversation earlier, that it's all very well saying AI is going to be our co-pilot in life and our day-to-day assistant, but if companies can save money on human beings and still boost their share price, what are they going to do in the pursuit of cash? They're going to lay off people and use systems that can operate, you know, 24/7, 365 days a year.
Will Guyatt, tech expert. And if you want to be really terrified and quite frankly very depressed, go to thetimes.com and look for that story. AI, just a year from beating all experts in humanity's last exam.
We've annoyed Cherie today as well, who says, what's wrong with off-ramp? I personally use exit, but off-ramp doesn't bother me. You're getting off the freeway. Well, it's an American term, Cherie, isn't it? And before you know it, we'll have fanny packs and broilers. We'll be driving sedans. Our relationship is not that special.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
But you are one of our favourite listeners, so keep it coming. It's 3 o'clock, you're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. And the next hour of the programme will bring you the latest after Tiger Woods was charged with driving under the influence. And we have the very best book recommendations from The Times and Sunday Times with cheeky Robbie Millen. First, the news with Stuart Willey.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister is to meet with the heads of energy, shipping and banking firms this afternoon as the war in Iran pushes up gas and oil prices. The price of a barrel of Brent crude has risen again today, up by 59% so far this month. Greg Newman is chief executive of the oil trading firm Onyx Capital. He told Times Radio it's full steam ahead for oil prices and the cost of living.
Diesel is in everything, transport, Amazon deliveries, you know, everything we do. So yes, it's going to have very serious impacts on the economy. And it's the most inelastic product in oil. You know, there's consistent demand around the world for diesel just to run our economy. Unfortunately, this just isn't an oil crisis. It's been considered that way. But I think given the price rises that are coming, this will be quite quickly a recessionary crisis and a general global financial crisis.
Donald Trump has issued a fresh warning to Iran over the Strait of Hormuz, saying he could obliterate power plants, oil wells and Karg Island if the waterway is not reopened. In a social media post, the president also said good progress was being made in negotiations. Earlier, he told a newspaper he could take Karg Island. The Sunday Times' Mark Urban says that could turn into a quagmire.
It's perfectly doable to take it. The question is, how do you hold it? And things like resupplying the troops there, you know, changing over, moving in one unit and taking out another one, those would all be points of vulnerability, which the Iranians would obviously attempt to exploit.
The BBC radio presenter Scott Mills has been sacked after allegations about his personal conduct. The corporation says the longtime DJ is no longer contracted and has left. It's understood he was taken off air from his Radio 2 programme last week. Here's Times Radio's Cara Bentley.
The Mirror, who first reported the story, say that they understand that the allegation relates to a historical relationship dating back more than 10 years. And in a statement to BBC staff, Lorna Clark, the director of music, said, "I know that this news will be sudden and unexpected and therefore must come as a shock. I felt it was important to share this news with you at the earliest opportunity."
Russell Brand's trial over allegations of rape and sexual assault has been delayed until October. A judge said the six-month postponement would help ensure there's enough time for the case after charges involving two additional complainants were added. The 50-year-old actor and comedian denies all the charges. The Foreign Office says Russia's latest expulsion of a British embassy staff member is part of what it calls a campaign of harassment. Moscow claims the man carried out subversive intelligence activities and gave false information about himself. Russia's FSB security service says he has 2 weeks to leave the country. And four masked men have stolen paintings worth millions of pounds in a heist on a museum in northern Italy. Three pieces by Renoir, Cezanne and Matisse were taken from a villa near Parma last Sunday. The gang were reportedly in and out within 3 minutes, interrupted by the site's alarm system. It follows the brazen daylight robbery at the Louvre in Paris. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Cherie, please don't worry. You may have heard the first bit, which was definitely me berating you. How dare you not agree with us on off-ramp? But you might have missed the second bit where we said that you are one of our favourite listeners, so please don't ever go anywhere. Scotty is very annoyed by off-ramp, though, saying it's an abomination, as is my bad.
When did we
start saying my bad?
I haven't started saying it.
And does anybody ever say my good? It's just my bad. Keep them coming, 0333 003 2353.
But can we mention Matt? Because I think that's a good point.
Yes, of course you can, go for it.
Parking. Matt says we should just take a leaf out of the French toll road system. Délai péage. Your toll tag also works in many car parks to pay for parking. You just drive in, drive out, and it adds the parking fee to your toll bill. Well, that just sounds like a very good idea. Frustrating that the French have had it, but it works like a dream, and you've used it, haven't you, apparently?
Yes, it seems to be a little bit easier to use than ours, because it's all connected to your number plate and your pay system. Could we just have télépéage from you one more time?
Télépéage.
Absolutely lovely. Écoutez.
I have an A-level in French.
Répétez.
Grade D.
It's 4 minutes past three. One from the last hour of the programme, we were talking about the joys of parenting. John says, after having my partner's sister and her 1 and 3-year-old staying with us since their births, I realised just how much I want kids. After years of disappointment in IVF, the stress causing the end of a relationship, I'm now looking into surrogacy on my own, as becoming a dad is the most important thing for me, even at 50. I can only thank those kids for opening my eyes to the joys of possible parenthood. They will stay with me even now, and I enjoy every minute with them for as long as it lasts.
I think that's lovely.
It is lovely, and it's not a perspective that we hear very often. 5 minutes past three. Women investigated or jailed for illegal abortion, some dating back to the Victorian era, are set to be pardoned. With records wiped, a new crime and policing bill will decriminalise abortion in England and Wales and overturn convictions under the 1861 law. That includes cases like Carla Foster, jailed in 2023, and about 100 women investigated over recent years. Eleanor Hayward is health editor at The Times. Eleanor, what does the new bill actually change in practical terms for women in England and Wales? Can you give us an example of a situation a woman might be in that would now be different?
Yeah, so there's been quite a lot of misinformation about the decriminalisation of abortion in the past couple of weeks, which is partly why I wrote this story. Because basically the bill means that women are removed from the criminal law. So at the moment, you can have an abortion within 24 weeks, but abortions after then, the women face the risk of prosecution. So this new law, it doesn't remove that time limit. The 24-week time limit is still in place. But if women lose their pregnancies after 24 weeks, currently some are facing really distressing investigations. And there's some examples of, say, women having stillbirths at like 30 weeks and then being arrested under suspicion of having an abortion illegally. And this law basically means that the threat of prosecution for women for abortions is completely removed. Although doctors say if they did abortions outside the 24-week time limit, they could still face prosecution.
Right. Can you just explain a bit more about where the medical profession lies and has lain in all of this? Because I suppose one of the obvious questions is, who is reporting a woman who would be in such distress having lost a baby so late in pregnancy, you know, wherever her mind is at, who would then turn that into something that involved the police? Would it be the doctor?
Yeah, I think if doctors have a suspicion or a concern that a late stage abortion has happened, then they do have a duty to report it to the police. But I think medical professions and campaign groups have been saying that this isn't really in anyone's best interest. It kind of just adds to what is already a very distressing and traumatic experience for women. And most countries, most Western countries, so like France, Australia, Canada, have decriminalised abortion as well. And so the UK is a bit of an outlier in a way, in that it is one of the only countries at the moment where women can actually be prosecuted for abortions.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the case I mentioned before coming to you, Carla Foster, jailed in 2023?
Yeah, she's one of the only examples of recent years of someone actually being prosecuted, being jailed for abortions. And she was a mother of three, and that case was in 2023. And she's one of the people who would benefit from this new pardoning clause that means anyone who has police records for abortions will have those wiped. Because at the moment, even if someone isn't convicted, if they've been investigated for abortion, then they have to disclose that in DBS checks and things like that. So if they're applying for jobs, that's always going to be on their records. And this new amendment, which only came in 2 weeks ago to the bill, means that those records will now be wiped, and convictions dating back to when the law was passed in 1861 will also be removed from the system.
What has sentencing been like in those recent cases?
There's only been, I think, six cases that have gone to court in the past few years, but that's charities are reporting quite a big increase in the number of investigations. And I think that Carla Foster, I think she was jailed for 2 years. And I think most of it was suspended. But she did go to jail. And that was, I think in her case, she'd taken abortion pills at home during the COVID pandemic. So that was when it was obviously very difficult accessing healthcare during COVID. And I think judges as well have spoken about them being quite uncomfortable with the law as it stands. And there was a case last year where a woman got acquitted by jury. She was called Nicola Packer. And she spoke out afterwards about how the law needs to change. And I think that's sparked quite a lot of the recent momentum we've seen for decriminalising abortion.
Thank you very much for explaining all of that. That's Eleanor Hayward, who's health editor at The Times. We can talk as well to Leslie Hall, historian of abortion and birth control. Leslie, can you just put this into context throughout history for us? How significant is it when we look back at the history of women's rights in the UK?
Well, it's quite extraordinary that there have been these recent cases, and it's actually worse than the Victorians. Because although under the 1861 Act, technically women could be prosecuted for procuring abortions themselves, as far as I know, cases were very, very rare. Historians have not, as it were, traced individual cases of women, specific women, being prosecuted for procuring their own abortions, as opposed to backstreet abortionists and slightly dodgy doctors being prosecuted for having done illegal operations, as they were known, on women. And that usually only happened anyway when the woman died from the abortion. Because it was really very, very difficult to police. It was a secret thing that happened in the privacy of women's own homes. And doctors were very cautious around it. And they were very, on the whole, they treated it in a very humane way. The most influential manual of medical jurisprudence, which is about how doctors' medicine intersects with the law at the time, said, well, you know, miscarriage is very common, and if a woman comes into hospital, which would actually be quite rare, poor women going into hospital with a miscarriage, you know, it could be for anything. You can't really suspect abortion. One thing they were cautious about was if they would be suspected themselves of procuring it. They got very edgy about that. But on the other hand, they were very sensitive about the law pressuring them on the matter.
Yeah.
And going to them and saying, well, you should ask these women who might be really, you know, on the point of dying. You must pressure them and ask them, who did this to you, you know, so we can prosecute the criminal abortion. The doctor said, this is not consistent with our duty of medical care. So there is a whole lot of tension in kind of Victorian England between doctors and the law on the subject.
Sure. And Leslie, can you just explain to us why we have fallen so far behind other countries with, I suppose, a similar mindset towards women? Why did the Offences Against the Person Act from 1861 remain in force for so long?
This is because the 1967 Abortion Act didn't actually overturn the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act clauses about abortion. It just created an exception to them where two doctors signed off that a woman was in medical need under the certain clauses of the 1967 Act, and the Act remained in force. Which is, you know, ridiculous. And I'm not sure why. And I think the reason that that happened was that because after the 1967 Act was passed, there was a huge backlash and attempts to even roll back that by the various anti-abortion movements of the time. And instead of moving forward with making the law more consistent and, you know, getting rid of these kind of fossilized remnants of the law, they were the pro-abortion movement was fighting an action just to keep the law, the 1967 Act, in force as it was. And you can see this, that there were constant attempts throughout the 1970s and early 80s to overturn the Abortion Act 1967.
Sure.
So that was the reason that it was never kind of increasingly rationalised.
So our attitudes, though, over access to abortion radically changed over the course of 100 years. I wonder what you think would happen or could happen over the next 100 years, because it is absolute fact that in other parts of the world where that same journey had been made, there is definitely a journey backwards now, isn't there?
Well, this has been going forward in some places and backwards in others. And although there have been these movements, and I think we are talking about America here while we're talking about the United
America,
States.
But also, interestingly, it's places like Poland as well, isn't it, Leslie? It's
yes,
not
well,
just America.
Poland was all, yes, well, Poland has a long tradition. I mean, it's a Catholic country, or was a Catholic country for many years. It has a long tradition where abortion was frowned on. But in America, I think there is a tension between, I think there is still a very strong majority of people actually are in sympathy with a woman's right to choose. But there are also these these interests which are trying to roll back all sorts of women's rights, well, not just women's rights, all sorts of what we think of as the reforms of the middle of the 20th century in terms of the rights of people who were not white middle-class males.
Leslie, very good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much for your time. That's Leslie Hall, who is a historian of abortion and birth control.
Let's bring in Cheryl, who says, I've only been listening for the past 40 minutes. Sorry, but I had a very pleasant birthday lunch. Well, you don't have to apologise. I mean, if it was your birthday, if it is your birthday, Cheryl, happy birthday to you. If it's someone else's birthday, I don't know why you had to go to the lunch when you could have been at home listening to us. But anyway, never mind. She goes on to say, have you covered the increasing use of the word gotten? Also, when did people stop dying and start passing away? I don't know. That's a very good point. Nick says, we say off-road, so what's wrong with off-ramp? I'm also all in favour of some lexical hooliganism. Oh, I like that. How about my smack has been gobbed, my gast is thoroughly flabbered, or my daisical is definitely lacking? And they're all good.
They're very good, but some of them sound like they're the caption under a cartoon that's slightly naughty.
Yes, actually, that's true. But Nick, thank you. Good work. 0333 003 2353. Coming up, the latest after the great golfer Tiger Woods was involved in another car crash at the weekend. It is 18 minutes past three. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tune in to Times Radio Breakfast. Why wouldn't you? We're live from 6 o'clock with all the news you need to hear from the UK and around the world.
We'll watch as the UK's deal with France to patrol beaches expires, and we'll get the latest weekly fuel prices plus quarterly GDP figures.
And we'll chew through the day's news with the former Conservative leader William Hague and the former Scottish Labour leader Kezia Dugdale.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk, other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
McGriddles, a new McDonald's breakfast. So it's maple syrup infused. It's sweet, then it's savoury. Because the sausage, you know, and the cheese and the egg. Oh, it's got the golden arches stamped on it too. Make that make sense. It's hard to put into words, but... Until 11 a.m, subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery orders while stocks last.
You're listening to Times Radio, where conversation goes beyond the headlines. When it comes to advertising, is your business showing up in environments where it's taken seriously? Or are you relying on word of mouth alone? Join us at the Times Radio advertising event in May. You'll receive a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices, and free creative designed to reflect the quality of your brand. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. Stop relying on word of mouth alone and start being heard.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio. This is Times Radio.
20 minutes past three, we'll talk about Spurs. Halcyon days ahead, they could only hope, in a couple of moments. We're now on the final countdown, though, to the 2026 Oxford versus Cambridge boat races, which happen on Saturday. For the first time, you'll be able to hear exclusive coverage and live commentary right here on Times Radio. The history of the race stretches back almost 200 years to 1829, when the men's race started. The women were allowed to compete for the first time in 1927, although compete is a stretch, as it was considered unladylike to actually race together, and they were instead judged on steadiness and style in the water. Yes. Do you know what? You only ever want a steady woman, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
No, especially in the 1920s. Times Radio's boat race reporter John Cushing looks back at a history of dead heat, sinkings and the occasional protester in the water.
Two British traditions come together this weekend. On Easter Saturday, two boat races with students from two universities doing battle to be one winner on the River Thames in rowing's greatest rivalry.
The University of Cambridge.
Hereby challenged.
Hereby challenged.
The University of Oxford.
To row a match at or near London.
Each in an eight-oared boat during the ensuing Easter vacation.
Two of this year's presidents, Gemma King of Cambridge and Oxford's Tobias Bernard, recreating the initial challenge nearly 200 years ago, and apt that that challenge was quite poetic. The nephew of William Wordsworth, Charles Wordsworth of Oxford, and Harrow school friend Charles Merivale of Cambridge, instigated the very first race, and Oxford won it.
At the first Henley race, 10,000 people turned up, and there was just huge interest in it, and there was no other game in town. It was the only sporting event in the country.
Former boat race director David Searle. It was another half a decade more when the second race, further down the River Thames in London, took place, before in 1845 the four-mile, 374-yard championship course was created from Putney downstream to Mortlake, with the finish just before Chiswick Bridge.
After almost 200 years now, you've always got conditions and unexpected events, and it's just an amazing thing that it keeps bringing out these surprises.
1877 saw the first official dead heat. 1839, the biggest winning margin of 35 lengths.
This is going to be an unbelievable finish. Oxford have won! Oxford have won! One of the greatest finishes of all time. And it's confirmed.
That was 2003, the weekend before Easter, and it was too close to call. Apart from then commentating legend and voice of the boat race, Barry Davis, who called it spot on. The Thames is not a mill pond or a lake like the Olympic rowing. It's a tidal river travelling at speeds of 5 miles an hour. That's quicker than multi-Olympic gold medalist Michael Phelps can swim.
Second women's boat race on the Tideway. Cambridge flooded in just ginormously waves. And they continued and they sort of got through Barnes Bridge and suddenly there was flat calm, which is what the Tideway does. And the pumps started working and then they went off and they finished. That was an amazing vindication of the decision to bring the women to the Tideway.
The women's race first started in 1927, a time trial on the River Isis in Oxford. The crews not allowed to race each other.
History is made on the Tideway.
And that was just before Easter, 11 years ago. The women's race finally moved to the same day, same course as the men, and we now have what's commonly known as the boat races.
You don't want to be the crew that loses. We are doing everything we can to make sure we're as fast as we can be on the day. We've got to do more than we did last year. We've got to find ways to improve. We can't just sit back and relax.
Cambridge University's now won the boat races more often, leading with 88 victories to Oxford's 81 in the men's boat race and 49-30 in the women's boat race. And one thing's for sure, this Easter, whatever the result, the rivalry remains.
And you can find out which crews make their mark on history this Saturday, the 4th of April. Join Jane Mulkerens, there's a steady woman for you, from 1 p.m. as she presents live coverage and commentary from Putney of both the men's and women's boat race, alongside former boat race winners and Olympic gold medalists Imogen Grant and Charlie Elwes. And Jane Garvey, you will be popping up as well.
Popping up, popping down. Hopefully not popping in. I don't want to go anywhere near the water. But I don't quite know why I've been called up to this, because neither Cambridge nor Oxford expressed any interest in educating me. I've never rowed.
It is because you are a steady woman.
I've rowed, but I've never rowed.
Maybe they just got that wrong.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, I'll be there. I've been promised, I think, the word PIMS came into the conversation, so I thought, oh, well.
I tell you what, that'll be worth listening out for.
Vassos is here to talk sport, more sport. Now, Tottenham are going to have another manager. It is their third of the season. So Thomas Frank was fired. Igor Tudor was never meant to be a permanent replacement, was he?
He was meant to get to the end of the season.
But he hasn't.
And what they were probably hoping for is that he would do really well and reunite the club, and then that they would give him an easy appointment, would just give him the role as a permanent manager.
Oh, I see.
Liz Truss lasted 45 days as Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. Igor Tudor has come to Spurs and he's lasted 44 days as manager. And as Martin Samuel writes in the Times this morning, more wins more often. Remember that? It was the mantra of the post-Daniel Levy regime at Tottenham. So how has that panned out? More managers more often. In fact, it would have been 30-something days, but his father passed away just during the last defeat a week ago, and so they it was seemly
yeah.
to give it a week and then get rid of Igor Tudor. And we are hearing that, I mean, it is ridiculous. Spurs, one of the big clubs, the big, just to put this in sort of some sort of context, Spurs have the probably best stadium, the first £1 billion stadium in Europe.
It was the Olympic Stadium, is that right?
No, no, it was that they got rid of White Hart Lane.
No, that's West Ham.
Yeah,
that's right. Go on.
But so, and they built their own stadium in the shadow of where White Hart Lane was, and it is staggering. It's really, it's a stadium of the future, and it still feels futuristic, and it's about 5 years old, and they are a big club, Spurs. They've never been relegated in the Premier League era. They now have more sacked managers than Premier League home wins since the end of last season, since May last year. It is extraordinary how badly things are going. Martin mentioned Daniel Levy there. He was the sort of the rod of iron CEO who was just all about the money and just making sure Spurs were a big success story, very much off the pitch and on the pitch. And then he resigned in October, and then it was going to be, now look at us, we're going to get back to the Spurs way of winning, playing beautiful football, and it has just crumbled beneath them.
Right, so who takes over now?
Roberto De Zerbi, former Brighton manager.
Now, we know this, do we?
Well, yes, essentially. It's not been confirmed yet, but he is in advanced talks. What he would like is to take over at the end of the season, assuming they don't get relegated. Spurs are saying, well, look, we can't do another Igor Tudor 44-day appointment because that didn't work. Would you mind taking over now? And they're offering him loads of money to do that. Some Spurs groups are very cross about it, not least because of how he dealt with a relatively contentious situation. So there's a Manchester United player called Mason Greenwood who had allegations including rape against him, which were dropped. And quite soon after that, Roberto De Zerbi signed him as manager of Marseille and described him as a good guy who was paying a heavy price for his past. And Spurs groups are saying that just does... Look, people look to the leadership of clubs, and if that is, you know, if that is the leadership of the club, that permeates down, and it is not a good look for Spurs to be appointing someone like Roberto De Zerbi. Obviously, Spurs aren't listening to those fan groups because it looks like he is going to be appointed, and he is... I mean, when he was manager of Brighton, just on a football basis, they played sort of high press, attacking, good football. It was nice, but that's what Igor Tudor's sides did. That's what their previous manager, Ange Postecoglou's sides did. No one quite knows what Thomas Frank's Spurs were meant to do, and he was the manager in between. But it is an absolute mess, and Spurs are 1 point and one place ahead of the relegation zone with 7 games to go. I mean, they are in a right old mess for a big club.
Yeah, now remind me, when does the Premier League start again? Because I think this weekend is...
FA Cup.
Yeah.
So we had a sort of double international break. There's an international break and then an FA Cup break. So he, if it's Roberto De Zerbi or if it's not him, it probably will be him, will have almost 2 weeks before the next game.
Do you know what I do? I mean, you don't care what I do. But what I do is, just to keep them up, I get Serena Wiegmann in. Just to keep them up until the end of the season. Be a great story, obviously only if she did it. And then she could go back to managing England women.
I mean, just, wouldn't it be brilliant?
Yeah.
And really, you know...
Pay her whatever she wants.
Absolutely, whatever you want. You've got 7 games.
Yeah.
Keep us up. And it would just be... I'd love to see the first female manager in the Premier League. That would just be... I mean, it would be groundbreakingly brilliant.
And especially coming in and sorting out a problem that have failed to sort out.
It's the old story, isn't it?
Well, it could be, but then people will hate us for saying this.
Well, let's just say it.
Is this a good joke from John?
No, well, it's interesting if you're a historical fan, as we are.
OK, I'm going to guess what the joke is.
Yeah,
I can't see. Is it something like it was the shortest Tudor reign since somebody in the Tudor period?
Yes.
You're absolutely spot on.
Poor benighted Lady Jane Grey.
Yeah.
Who reigned for 9 days, I think, and she was killed just down the river here.
Was she?
The Tower.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible, terrible times. Let's talk about Tiger Woods.
Well, she got tea named after her.
That's true, but I don't think it's her, is it? No, it's not even her.
What, Lady Jane Grey tea?
That's not her.
Is it not her?
No. Oh, lordy. So, Tiger Woods, he's obviously... it's actually really depressing, this saga, isn't it? He's not very well. He's in a lot of pain. And what exactly happened? What do we know about what happened the other day?
So he was trying to overtake somebody on a road in Jupiter Beach in Florida and had another car crash. I mean, this is his 1, 2, 3, 4th car crash. The first time when there was that sort of, you know, he had a big marital row, didn't he? And he reversed his car into a fire hydrant. He was found to have sleeping pills in his system. That was back in 2009. He was found asleep at the wheel of his car with the engine running in 2017. And he was tested for drugs then, and he entered a program for first-time DUI offenders. It was prescribed, something prescribed, sort of sleeping medication, I think. And that first sort of mug shot with sunken eyes that we saw of the, you know, Tiger Woods. And we had another one just now in 2021, actually. He overturned a car, nearly lost a leg, and Californian police were criticised for not testing for impairment, but he has been now. They are preparing charges. They're looking at the skid marks to see what speed he was travelling. What it shows, I mean, he has been a sports person of extreme highs and extreme lows, and it is, you know, it is showing a deeply troubled side to this sporting megastar. It's very sad, actually.
It is sad. You're absolutely right. Vassos, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vassos Alexander with the day's sport.
3:32 coming up, the very best book recommendations from the Times and Sunday Times. And what does the war in Iran mean for your pension? Let's get the latest news headlines with Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has hailed what he calls great progress towards a deal with Iran, but in a social media post warned he could obliterate Karg Island if the Strait of Hormuz is not reopened. An Iranian official has described the American proposals as unrealistic, illogical and excessive, and insisted Tehran will continue to defend itself. The Times correspondent Richard Spencer is in Tel Aviv.
Karg Island, which is where the oil terminal is, handles 80 to 90% of Iran's oil exports. That would be obviously a strategic blow to Iran if America sees that. That appears to be the threat that Trump is making. Taking them is one thing, of course, holding them is another.
The Prime Minister will shortly meet bosses from major energy firms to discuss rising living costs. It comes as the price difference between diesel and petrol in the UK has reached its highest level since at least 2003. According to the RAC, the average price of a litre of diesel rose to almost £1.80 on Sunday, 28 pence more than petrol costs. The city watchdog is announcing final rules for a redress scheme this afternoon for those who have been missold car finance. There are also plans to crack down on misleading advertising for those making a claim. And a major study has found running for the bus could help slash the risk of heart disease, dementia and arthritis. Researchers are backing up NHS recommendations for adults to do at least 150 minutes of moderate exercise a week. Don't forget, you can set the Times Radio News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
You've saved carefully for your future, your plans, your peace of mind. Now there's good news. FSCS protection for your savings and current accounts has risen to £120,000 per eligible person at UK authorised banks, building societies and credit unions. From the very first pound right up to £120,000, it's all protected. So you can focus on what matters with confidence. See what it means for you at fscs.org.uk. Your savings, FSCS protected.
First time in premium economy, you'll double check your ticket. Second time, you'll wonder why you waited. Third time, you'll never go back. With generous legroom, Wi-Fi and dishes by Michelin-starred chefs, you'll feel like Asia just got closer. Cathay Pacific, move beyond.
This is Times Radio.
25 minutes to four. Let's cheer ourselves up with a cultural interlude. We'll get sophisticated and draw back the curtain to our literary salon. We're joined by Robbie Millen, literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Hello, Robbie.
Gosh, that's a sort of heavy burden.
I have laid it all in front of you. Yes.
Cheer us up.
And will the first book you're talking about cheer us up?
No.
You are the Fuhrer's Unrequited Love.
Oh, I don't think it will cheer us up.
By Jean-Noël Arango.
Arango, it's a good name, isn't it? It's a great title, You Are the Fuhrer's Unrequited Love. And it's, I mean, that's the reason why I read it, because it's an unusual title. And it is about Hitler's unrequited love. And that unrequited love was Albert Speer. You remember the architect, great architect. And then later on in the war, I mean, he basically, you know, the kind of the Nazi aesthetic. If you think of the Nuremberg rally with all the kind of the lights and the marching, that was all him. Right. Sort of like a choreographer of totalitarianism. Oh, that sounds clever, doesn't it? But later on, then during the war, he became Minister of Production, Armed Production. But they had this sort of strange, according to this novelist, almost homoerotic relationship. Obviously never...
Requited.
Yeah. And you kind of think, well, this is a very weird premise for a book. But then you start actually looking at Albert Speer's memoirs, and it's all there. There's these sort of weird moments when... Albert Speer had been showing his plans for a new Berlin to Hitler, and Hitler was obviously looking at him in a gooey-eyed way that this kind of SS officer who saw it afterwards said, you know what, you are Speer, you're Hitler's unrequited love. And this is like 1939 1940. There's these moments, like they'd be at a party, and you know that thing you sometimes do when you catch someone's eye and then hold it. So you had these sort of weird staring matches with Hitler. And then it was like Hitler would look away. Imagine looking into those mad eyes. So it's a very strange novel, but absolutely fascinating, thought-provoking, because it's one of those, I think you'd call it either a non-fiction novel or a factual novel, in that the author uses all the tricks of novel writing, sort of imagining what the person's saying, but it's all drawn from the historical records. So things that you have happening in Albert Speer's head, you look in his memoirs, and that's what he was thinking. So it's a really weird insight into a peculiar and unpleasant time.
It does sound extraordinary. Let's move on. Capital by John Lanchester. His new novel, Look What You Made Me Do, is out now.
It came out a couple of weeks ago. So I've been on a bit of a John Lanchester reading binge. You may well remember Capital. It came in about 2012. Nice thick book, but it takes one road in somewhere in South London. It's never quite mentioned. And then looks at the lives of all the people on the road. And it's sort of very much, it captures a particular moment. It's one of those novels that will last a long time, because if you want to know what was it like in 2012, this is the kind of novel that gives you that, you know, what were house prices like? And obviously, half the country are absolutely obsessed with house prices, and it kind of plays into that. But you've got sort of the new wealth coming in, the kind of older people have sort of stuck around and seen the road changing. It's all basements being dug out and things like that. And it's just, he sets it in 2008, sorry, not 2012, written, published in 2012. So just as the crash is coming.
Word.
All those poor bankers losing their bonuses.
And is it? I haven't read it actually. Is it seen through the eyes of anybody, or
this group of characters?
Okay, right.
And all their lives gradually intertwine. It's really well done. If you want one of those kind of books that's going to keep you going for a couple of weeks, you know, 50 pages, 20 pages a night, or whatever, it's one of those. Lots of characters.
Do you know, I do love a book that stays in one place. Increasingly, actually. Well, just because I don't know what that's about. Just the aging process, or my eyesight being a bit annoying to read for long periods of time. But I find it incredibly helpful to not have to bounce around.
Oh, and no, actually, split timelines, you mean?
Oh, things split like, timelines.
Oh, my goodness. No, are we in a flashback or flashing forward?
Yep, you're suddenly in Moscow in 1948 and I've got to regroup my thoughts. So actually just a road in South London.
The great
me,
novelist Colm Tobin, who wrote Brooklyn, things like that, his rule is no flashbacks, start here and go forward.
Oh, he's so right.
He's right, and that's why he's, I think, so good.
Yeah, I like that very much. And actually, it lies at the heart of Jenny Godfrey's books, doesn't it? They all take a place and everything emerges around that. And I throw that in because she's a favourite of ours on the podcast, isn't
she? She's writing her third novel now, isn't she? About the year
1997.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because I've forgotten the name of her.
The Barbecue at Number 9 is her second one, and The List of Suspicious Things was her first one.
Well, The Barbecue at Number 9 is a very similar thing. It takes one street, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And, okay, uses that particular... It's one afternoon, isn't it?
I think it's just such a clever conceit.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Glyn, regular correspondent, just wants to take issue with you. I think Robbie Millen sometimes thinks you two are older than you actually are. Every week he says, you remember, and talks about some event or person way beyond your years. Today it was the Nuremberg rally. Which I don't think either of you covered in your five live days, no.
I don't know. Are you sure? Can we have an on-the-record denial?
Honestly, Robbie, please, have some respect.
That's very true, you do. Right, your third
book. Well, you know
book.
Who Gracie Fields is. All oh, because no, that one Gracie time we mentioned Gracie Fields.
Gracie Fields again. Like a Cat Loves a Bird, The Nine Lives of Muriel Spark by James Bailey is out now.
Yeah, well, sort of out next week or so. Yeah, no, it's a sort of, it's a biography of Muriel Spark, probably most famous for the prime of Miss Jean Brodie. You'll remember Maggie
Smith.
Don't start.
Don't say you'll remember. We might not.
You will remember.
Okay.
Try us. You remember the prime of Miss Jean Brodie? Have you read it?
Yes, I have read it.
You've seen the film with Maggie Smith. Remember her?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I have seen the film with Maggie Smith.
I've seen the film.
Well,
no,
how
but
can
I have
you not
it?
Seen the film?
Well, we were out and about, you know, probably entertaining the troops. Carry on.
Anyway, so it's a biography.
We're in Germany, Robbie. Yes.
And Muriel Spark, I think, she's probably one of our greatest 20th century novelists. But she's such an interesting woman because she was a bit. She had moments when she was. She went a bit mad at moments. She had the kind of fixation that T.S. Eliot was stalking her and things like that. And he was also moonlighting as a window cleaner in South Kensington.
T.S. Eliot?
Yes. He wasn't, just to reassure readers. But it's a very playful and rather amusing biography. And I think it captures something of her because one of Muriel Spark's complaints was that one previous biographer she said, you know, you make me sound like someone who's never cracked a joke. Well, her novels are really quite trippy and strange and funny. And I don't know why I'm looking at you so intensely.
Who's James Bailey, the biographer?
I think this is his first book. He's a young, academic.
Gosh, that's quite bold, isn't it?
It is bold to take on one of the big beasts, or beastettes. So anyway, my love of Muriel. People should read Muriel Spark, simple as that. I know I shouldn't really say this. If I had my way, I'd have the whole book section just reviewing old books by Muriel Spark.
Well, what would happen if you did ask for that just for one edition of the paper?
I think...
Would people say you're seeing window cleaners in South London?
Exactly. I think the white coat would be provided for me. And
which literary great do you think could make a reasonable fist of being a window cleaner?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, I'm just trying... Do you think... who would sort of...
Well, Richard Osmond, because he's tall... But,
Richard Osmond, yes. Okay. But, yeah, you wouldn't need a ladder.
No, he wouldn't, yes. Mm. Good question.
But at the same time, I think you have to... maybe it's more helpful to be small and nimble. So, you know, you can stand on a windowsill without fear of... Well, there'd always be fear of falling off.
Ali Smith is quite short, Scottish novelist. So she might be fast up a ladder. Mm. Don't know. I've never given this any thought.
No, I'm struggling to give it some thought now, actually. If people wanted an introduction to Muriel Spark, would it be the prime of Miss Jean Brodie that you would point them to first?
I think so, yes. But by the end, she hated that novel because it was her big banger, her successful one. A lot of novelists, they sort of get upset with the ones that overshadow all the others. But it is such an unusually interesting, funny novel and very quotable. Because there's that great line, do you remember, in the film?
I'm bound
not
to.
You were in the film, no, you know, and also in the novel, of course. But she seeks to intimidate me with the use of the quarter hour.
Very good.
So if you ever set up, someone tries to invite you for a meeting at 3:15 and they're using the quarter hour...
Is that a rather passag thing to
do? It is very passag, isn't it?
I thought about that.
Yes.
Oh, there's so much I haven't thought about that you brought to my attention.
Brian Dobson, one of our more intellectual listeners, was straight in there 7 minutes ago. He texted to say it's 35 minutes past three. I think this is a reference, isn't it, maybe?
Oh.
To that.
Yes.
Isn't that clever?
It was.
Yeah. We love our listeners. Sometimes, yes. Brian, we don't understand you. We need some help to get there, but we have got there eventually. Are you one of those literary editors who would actually like to be the subject of the reviews yourself? Have you written books?
No. Do you know what? We got this cupboard downstairs where we put all the books that come in, and there are hundreds and hundreds, two sacks every day. And we call it the cupboard of disappointments because so many people work hard to create these books and a lot of them just won't find an audience because there's a lot produced. We can only cover so many. We can only. I mean, this is my big fear. I think I've said this before, that there's a Jane Austen of our era working today, unrecognised. Because often all the great people are only retrospectively regarded as great.
And you're worried that you're missing them.
Yes, yeah. And they will look foolish.
Yeah. Well, it is a difficult landscape out there, though, isn't it, for the novelist who doesn't have connections or a massive Absolutely. Social media presence or has been on Strictly Come Dancing
yes.
or has a ghostwriter or a powerful agent. So, yeah.
I know you're a big Anton Dubec fan and his many novels.
Yes, I find his plot lines very...
You're on very dangerous territory here, Robbie. You're very naughty. Right, I think we should bring this to an end. Whatever yes. that was, it's over.
I know. It was free as well.
Right.
Well, free to you. I think it's cost me a lot.
It probably has. Thank you, Robbie Millen. Now, next on Times Sorry. Radio, going to move on to an area which is causing a lot of vexation to the older people like Fee and I. Yeah. How is the war in the Middle East affecting our pension pots? And whenever I say that, I cringe because there's so much genuine suffering going on. But there is absolutely no doubt about the fact that for a lot of mithering middle-aged folk, me, this is a massive issue.
Oh, yeah, count me in too.
And you, Robbie, right. So stay listening, particularly you, Robbie. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Coming soon, rowing's greatest rivalry, live and exclusively on Times Radio.
The UK government is backing businesses with support to sell to the world. James Markey is a technology entrepreneur with Unisim and an export champion for the Department for Business and Trade.
Hi, I'm James. I created a portable training simulator for dental and medical students. It uses haptics, which is virtual touch, and VR so they can practice safely before treating real patients. In 2019, Adema University in Mallorca bought 8 of these straight away, but I didn't really have a clear path to grow internationally. Then I was introduced to a local government-backed initiative supporting business growth. It helped us fund a portable prototype and connected me to the UK government's Department for Business and Trade. That support changed everything. Unisim's now a six-figure exporter, 90% of that overseas. For us, export support wasn't just a nice extra. It really has been transformational.
To find out more about how your company could benefit from UK government support, visit business.gov.uk.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Charlie says, were you dancing around Anton's literary skills? Well, I think you were, Fee.
I don't think I was, actually.
No.
I think I was well and truly exposing my point of view there.
Tripping the light fantastic, that's what she was doing. And Paul has this offering. Laurie Lee worked on building sites in Battersea between the wars. It was mentioned in As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. He'd happily clean windows, I'm sure. Right. I don't know how we got on to which literary great would be the best window cleaner.
You asked.
Did I?
Yes, you did.
Am I short-term memory? Okay, I'm to blame. Now, we're going to talk now to Megan Harwood-Baines, senior money reporter at The Times. Welcome, Megan. Nice to see you. You're going to explain exactly what's happening in the world of pensions. And I do mean it when I say that, obviously, you listen to the news, you watch it at night, and you appreciate that some people are having unimaginable horrors unleashed upon them every day. And here in the West, some smug people, myself, my thoughts do stray occasionally to how my pension might be faring. So having owned all that, what is happening in the world of pensions?
I think it's very normal to, be worrying about how your pension's doing. I'm one of those people who obsessively checks my pension, even though I'm only in my 30s.
I was going to say, you're a very early adopter.
I find it fascinating. And many people who have been logging in over the last month will have seen their pension pots go down. Sort of data shows that only 5% of funds have been returning a positive amount since the start of the war. So you're probably logging in and thinking, where's all my money gone?
Yeah, okay. Actually, just as a point, should you actually check that often, or is it just better just to have a couple of glances once or twice a year?
I think it depends where you are in that sort of lead up to retirement. I know probably in your 30s you shouldn't be checking it every month. There is something to be said about, you know, checking it, like if you're on maternity leave and making sure you're being paid the right amount if your circumstances change like that.
Yeah.
As you get closer to retirement, you may want to start checking in a bit more and just make sure that your goals for retirement are kind of aligned with how you're saving. So what kind of fund you're putting it into, making sure you're de-risking at the right time.
OK, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Can we just get to the real basics? Why has the closure of a shipping lane done quite big amounts of damage to pension pots?
Sure. So closing the Strait of Hormuz, it's cut off a key shipping lane for oil and gas, and that's just sent international markets into havoc. And while we don't import much oil from the Gulf, it has put us into a bidding war with countries that do. So that has driven up the price of our oil. And oil does so much more than fuel our cars. It's this foundational cost that just affects every part of the economy. It affects transporting every product, making every product. So when the price of that goes up, inflation goes up. When this happens, people start to panic and they start to sell off their shares. They start to remove themselves from the stock market. So it means pension funds that have stocks, you know, have the same stocks, they'll see the value start to go down.
I see. OK. And at that point, if your pension is being managed for you by somebody else or something else, what can you do as an individual?
So a lot of us will be in the default fund, particularly if you save via auto-enrolment into a workplace pension.
Yeah.
So that generally doesn't expose you to as much risk. There's sort of three levels of risks with a lot of workplace pensions. There's adventurous, there's balanced, there's cautious. Most of us will find ourselves in the balanced fund, which should limit some of our exposure to these big movements. If you're like me and you're, you know, not thinking about retiring for a long time, if possibly ever, you might have put your fund into a more adventurous way of saving, which means you're going to see these big dips. But because you're further from retirement, you've got more time to recover.
I see. So if you are dependent on your auto-enrolment pension with your employer, who do you ring if you'd rather go to the really safe option at the moment, if that's what you want to do?
So a lot of them have sort of apps or ways of logging in online.
If so, you can sort of just do it?
Yeah, you can log in. I changed mine and it took about 5 minutes. You log in, you get a big list of all the ones that are available. You can even pick particular funds if you want to. I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to go in sort of a general management, and then you click it and it does it, and then you can choose whether or not you want to move your existing funds into the different way of saving, or if any future funds go into that.
OK, so that's auto-enrolment. What if you've got a self-invested, a SIP? What can you do then?
So again, you'll probably have made a choice with your saving as to how you want to save. So if you've got a SIP, you might have invested in an eco fund, or, you know, again, a more balanced or more cautious one. The main thing is, as you're sort of nearing retirement, think, well, when do I want to retire? How do I want to retire? What's that going to look like? Do I need to be moving my money away from these riskier investments into something that is more cautious if I'm thinking of retiring in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years?
OK. And again, how do you do it? I mean, it sounds it's easy enough to say, look, I'm retiring, I think, in 2 years' time. I'd like to go into safer territory. Mm-hmm. What am I required to do?
I would definitely contact your pension provider, talk to them. Most of them will have advisors who can say, well, this is what you would need to do if this is the kind of retirement you're looking for.
Right. OK. And they will then they will do that for you? Or mean, or do you have to sign a piece of paper to allow that to happen?
So a lot of them have this thing called lifestyling where it automatically does it for you. So as you get closer to retirement, it automatically de-risks you. Now, there's risks within de-risking, because if you de-risk too early...
This is where I get confused, because I appreciate that's true, of course. There are risks in de-risking because actually chances are this awful crisis will fade into the background, or it'll reach some sort of conclusion in the next, we hope, couple of months, and then it could be boom time, boom time again. But you might be in the wrong place with your pension.
Exactly. So I would say never make any snap decisions. I was looking it up, how the markets were affected by Trump's tariff war. So At the start of April, the S&P 500 dropped 12% last April, but by May the 2nd, everything had bounced back. So stuff can bounce back, and it can bounce back much quicker than you think. And if you're still putting money into your pension, what you're doing is you're buying stocks at a much lower price. So when it does bounce back, actually, you could end up better off. So continue paying in. Don't rush to make any decisions. Draw your money out of any particular place.
OK, you've anticipated my next question, because I wonder whether some people might be thinking, look, I pay 500 quid. I'm relatively fortunate. I put 500 quid into my pension every month. I'm wondering whether I might be better off sticking it into a cash ISA and hedging my bets that way.
So I did a piece 2 weeks ago looking at what would have happened if you were the unluckiest investor over the last 30 years. And it looked at if you put money into the markets before every big crash, so the dot-com burst, COVID, all of that. And it came back and it said you would still, your money would have grown by 340% over the last 30 years. If you'd put that same amount in cash, it would have grown by 65%.
Wow.
So, even if you're incredibly unlucky, long term, and if you're thinking long term, which most pensions are, you're going to still be much better off. Just continue to invest, delete the apps off your phone if you find yourself checking too much, and it's going to be okay. Don't panic.
Okay, I do. That is really, really interesting. That contrast in the growth is, do them again. The stocks was how many? 300?
I believe it was 340%.
Wow.
And compared. It was over the last 30 years.
Yeah. Okay, so you do have to have time on your side. So somebody of your age, genuinely, you can ride this out. And somebody who's, I don't know, in their first job and is 24, what would their best way forward be right now?
Just keep chipping away, you know, save as much as you can sort of reasonably afford to. And obviously it's difficult saving into a pension at the moment. Everything's expensive, housing's expensive, the weekly shop is expensive. But just keep saving as much as you can. If you get a pay rise, the best thing to do is immediately, you know, recalculate your pension contribution. So it's almost like you never had that money. So you just get used to however much is being paid to you at the end of the month.
Keith says, you only want to think about de-risking if you're thinking of an annuity. And that should be the minority of people these days. Leave your money invested. Time in the market beats all. Well, that effectively is what you're saying, isn't
it? Yeah, that's very true. Although annuities have become popular again. They were, you know, they've sort of reached record highs in terms of what you can get. But yeah, I mean, for many of us, retirement could be sort of 20, 30 years. So even if you're thinking, oh, I'm going to retire in 2 years, you could still be invested for sort of 20 years.
Yeah, okay. And B says, Jane and Fee have got gold-plated pensions from the BBC.
Well, we haven't.
No, we just haven't.
No, we just haven't, because it was made very clear to us if we wanted to stay on at the BBC as presenters, we were freelance people. So we haven't had a BBC pension. I think I had one that lasted probably 2 or 3 years after the IR35 change.
Well, there we are, B. That's put you in the picture there. We don't have gold. Some people have gold-plated
Well,
BBC
they
pensions.
Absolutely do.
They're called managers.
Yeah, but I would hate people to think that that's you and me, because as you can tell by our very sharp spark of curiosity about current pension investment.
We are very much
keen to know more.
Yes, we really are. But we always welcome your messages. You can tell us, and you can tell us what you like, and you can ask us what you like. It's just water off a duck's back, isn't it? But we really aren't old enough to remember some aspects of world history. I really must have a word with Robbie about that. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp number. Keep it close, stick it in your phone, and you can contact us again tomorrow afternoon between 2 and 4. Megan Harwood-Baines, thank you so much. Senior money reporter at The Times, thank you.
Exciting guests for you after 3:30 for the rest of the week. Tomorrow it is John Batiste. On Wednesday it's Dig Able. And on Thursday it is the mighty William Boyd.
Thank you. John's next.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The Prime Minister is meeting with the heads of energy, shipping and banking firms this afternoon as the war in Iran pushes up gas and oil prices. And Donald Trump has issued a fresh warning to Iran over the Strait of Hormuz, saying he could obliterate power plants, oil wells and Karg Island if the waterway is not reopened. And coming up, the journalist Edward Luce on his interview with Donald Trump, Alan Eyre, a distinguished diplomatic fellow with the Middle East Institute who was a key member of the team negotiating the Iran nuclear agreement. They're going to be with me to talk about the latest moves in Iran and the crisis.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Eliza Phillips.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister is meeting with the heads of energy, shipping and banking firms at Downing Street as the war in Iran pushes up gas and oil prices. Earlier, Sir Keir Starmer launched Labour's local election campaign, saying he would bear down on the cost of living. He also said the government would resist pressure to be drawn further into the conflict in Iran.
This is not our war, and we are not going to be dragged into it. Yes, of course, we will defend British lives and British interests in the region. We'll stand by our allies in the Gulf region.
The price of Brent crude has risen again today, now up by 59% so far this month. The RAC says petrol and diesel prices have reached their highest level since the end of 2022. Downing Street says forecourts are well stocked and motorists should fill up as normal. But a former government advisor has told Times Radio measures to preserve fuel may be needed. Adam Bell is a partner with consulting firm Stonehaven.
The Prime Minister says that there's no need for any motorists to do anything different yet. That's probably quite optimistic. I think certainly in other territories you've seen measures like asking people to go slower, asking people to work from home if they can, to reduce the demand for fuel, at least in the short run. If the war continues, then by the middle of the month, the Prime Minister will start saying, well, perhaps some voluntary measures might be appropriate.
Meanwhile, the US president has made fresh threats to blow up Iran's electricity plants and oil wells if a deal is not reached soon. Donald Trump has claimed to be in talks with a new regime in Tehran, saying negotiations are making great progress. Elsewhere, the BBC radio presenter Scott Mills has been sacked after allegations about his personal conduct. The corporation says the longtime DJ is no longer contracted and has left. It's understood he was taken off air from his Radio 2 programme last week. Here's Times Radio's Cara Bentley.
The Mirror, who first reported the story, say that they understand that the allegation relates to a historical relationship dating back more than 10 years. And in a statement to BBC staff, Lorna Clark, the director of music, said, "I know that this news will be sudden and unexpected and therefore must come as a shock. I felt it was important to share this news with you at the earliest opportunity."
The Foreign Office says Russia's latest expulsion of a British embassy staff member is part of what it calls a campaign of harassment. Moscow claims the man carried out subversive intelligence activities and gave false information about himself. Russia's FSB security service says he has 2 weeks to leave the country. A national police operation has been launched to tackle abuse of election candidates ahead of May's local elections. Led by the National Police Coordination Centre, Operation Gargile will offer security briefings and support to those standing for the Scottish Parliament, Welsh Senate and English councils. And a nightclub at the centre of a meningitis outbreak in Kent says it will reopen on Thursday. Club Chemistry says health authorities have downgraded the risk level in Canterbury. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello, welcome to Drive on Times Radio with me, John Pienaar. Thanks for joining me. As oil prices spike upwards again, as the Prime Minister sits down with energy company bosses to discuss fuel shortages, and with fuel rationing an option for the not-too-distant future, President Trump has set out his thinking on the war in Iran, which triggered this crisis. On today's show, I'll have the latest on the crisis for you. I'll have the latest on that meeting and on where the war may be heading, judging by President Trump's latest interview. I say maybe heading because reporting Trump's words inevitably involves wandering into a maze of contradictions, loose ends and assertions of fact which are often nothing of the kind. But whether contacts with Iran are making progress, as he says, or whether they're not, whether he'll order ground troops to seize Iranian territory and Iranian oil installations, or whether he doesn't, we will be having the conversation about what is going on the ground and what it means. Will the president obliterate not just Karg Island, the country's oil depot, but Iran's water desalination plants, as he's just threatened to do on social media? Or is that another dire threat ahead of another climb down? Donald Trump commands the most powerful military power in this war and across the world. So what he says matters if you can understand him. So let's try. Whether Trump somehow brings the war to an end within weeks or whether it becomes the long entanglement he's anxious to avoid and many Americans and so many others dread, no one can tell. But we'll look at that question too. I wonder what you're thinking. Send me a text, 8722. Start with the word Times or tweet to @TimesRadio. First then,
In a post on the president's Truth Social platform, Donald Trump threatened to obliterate all of Iran's electrical plants and oil wells and Hog Island if a peace deal wasn't reached. Conversely, he said the deal was very close with a new, more reasonable regime. On Air Force One last night, the president assured reporters that Iran had been militarily destroyed.
They are decimated right now. They're going to give up nuclear weapons. They're going to give us the nuclear dust. They're going to do everything that we want to do. And you know what? They're going to go on and maybe have a great country again. But if they don't do that, they're not going to have a country.
Now, hundreds of U.S. Special Forces personnel, including Navy SEALs and Army Rangers, are thought to have arrived in the Middle East. But Richard Spencer, the foreign correspondent at the Times, has been telling Times Radio that we shouldn't expect another Iraq-style conflict.
It's nothing like what we saw in Iraq 23 years ago. There's an extra few thousand. There's two Marine Expeditionary Forces. One has just arrived, one is on its way. They have about 3,500 troops each, a couple of thousand Marines. Then there's some paratroops going and an infantry battalion as well, we're told. So on top of the existing force in the Middle East, there are about 40,000 American troops dotted around the Middle East. So if you got them all together, that is, still only a third of the number of troops that they had to invade Iraq. And Iran is a much bigger country. So I think we can say there's nothing like that on the cards.
Well, I'll be talking live to Richard Spencer of the Times very shortly. But the US national editor for the Financial Times, Edward Luce, spoke with the president over the weekend. I caught up with Edward before the show, and I asked him what the president said on that call.
So my sort of broader sort of Uber takeaway, if you like, from this is a 15-minute call, was that the president doesn't have anything new to get him out of this situation that he's largely placed himself in. He was talking about seizing the oil, but that's the equivalent in American football of what they call a Hail Mary. Seizing the oil, sounds good if you're thinking about the Venezuela example, but in the completely different Iranian and the Gulf conditions, it would be a massive risk, a huge risk.
And President Trump has had something of a fixation with seizing Iranian oil for literally decades, hasn't he? I was looking at a clip of him saying very much that from 1987.
He has Iranian oil, then Iraqi oil, then Iranian oil again.